The Athletic.
If you're not yet a subscriber to The Athletic, now's the time with our best offer ever. Sign up today and you'll pay just £1 a month for the next 6 months, giving you unrivaled insight and analysis of everything Euro 2020 and taking you well into the new Premier League season too. The Athletic is the only place you can read pieces by award-winning writers like Michael Cox, Rafa Honigstein, Amy Lawrence and Daniel Taylor. And when you subscribe, you'll also get ad-free versions of all of The Athletic's podcasts from across its audio network. Head to theathletic.com/totally and become a subscriber today for £6 until the end of the year. That's theathletic.com/totally.
Good afternoon, passengers. This is a pre-boarding announcement for flight 89. Please have your boarding pass and identification ready.
Baku, Sevilla,
Amsterdam,
Glasgow,
München,
St. Petersburg,
Bucharest,
Budapest,
Copenhagen,
Roma,
London.
Unbelievable! Totally at the Euros. Sunday's action. Holy shit, the Czechs have put the Dutch out. They're in the quarters, while De Boer joins a long list of managers, Dutch or otherwise, that have had problems with the Czechs. Harry Redknapp amongst them. Meantime, Belgium put out the holders in Seville to book a clash with Italy. We review that and check out Monday's games in prospect. World champions France taking on the Swiss, while Croatia face Spain, who smashed them 6-0 last time. That and some more vintage Euro on this day-ness in this totally football show at the Euros in association with Paddy Power. Hello, listener. Monday, the 28th of June, and here to greet with you the new week. We have Enthusiasm's Michael Cox. Hello, Michael.
Hi, James.
Nice to see you. And experiencing sport as vertical streams of green numbers is Duncan Alexander. Duncan.
I think it's black numbers on a green screen, but yeah, that was close. So yeah, hello.
Fair point. Welcome to you as well. Welcome to you as well. It was a monumental day. Second day of the knockout stage of this Euro competition. It brought the biggest fixture and the biggest shock of the tournament so far, would you say, Michael?
Yeah, I'd agree with that. Belgium-Portugal I was looking forward to. Not sure it completely justified our excitement, but it was all right. And then, yeah, I mean, Netherlands started as favourites against Czech Republic. I thought they were the better side, really, at 0-0 until the sending off changed things. But, yeah, it was a pretty good day, I would say.
Interesting. That was a 2-0 win for the Czech Republic in Budapest, and they'll be up against Denmark next in Baku, while Sunday evening in Seville, as mentioned, Portugal, the holders, exiting thanks to Torgan Hazard's very lovely goal for Belgium. Belgium will next up be facing Italy in what producer Charlie points out will be an interesting reprise of the 2013 FA Cup final with Roberto Martinez up against Bobby Mancini. Crikey. All right, well, we'll start off with the Czechs.
You're listening to the Totally Football Show, sponsored by Paddy Power and part of the Athletic Podcast Network.
Van Lynch naar rechts. There in the streets of Amsterdam, as thousands of Netherlands supporters prepared for Sunday afternoon's game with the same breezy confidence as Mikael Jongsma on this show just yesterday. Netherlands had, after all, flown through their group as the tournament's highest scorers. The Czechs, meanwhile, had scraped out of theirs in third place. But inside the Puskas Arena, there was a surprise in store.
Maar eerst deze Tsjechische doorbraak zien door te komen. En dat is ons niet gegeven. Daar is de goal van Patrick Schick. En hier mag je aannemen, valt het doek. Het valt stil in het oranje vak.
Huge save for the Czechs, a red card for Netherlands, then two Czech goals from Thomas Hullers and Patrick Schick to send Netherlands out and the Czechs into the quarters. Straight after the game, Czech journalist Karel Haring of Football Club magazine joined us from Prague with his reaction. The one win in the group stage came in that, at times, magnificent performance against Scotland, but this seemed like the whole team had stepped up a level. What do you think happened today?
I think it was the kind of the opponents the Czech team like to play against. I would compare it with the game in March this year when Czech team played against Belgium in the World Cup qualifiers, and it finished 1-1, and it was a really good performance because I would say this team, you know, they don't have a big stars. Netherlands have much more better individually, more skilled players. But this team is usually strong when they can play against team who likes offensive football, and they can prepare tactically for them. And we could see it today. The Czech team was pressing high. They were, of course, except the first 10 minutes, they were prepared for the wingbacks. So it was kind of opponent, and maybe even historically we can see it on head-to-head records against Netherlands, because from last, now it's from last 8 games, Czech Republic won 5 and lost only 2, and it was really big games against big teams of Netherlands. So maybe the style of touch football is something what Czech teams can find weapons against.
Mm. Certainly the red card for De Ligt helped the Czech Republic in towards this victory, but it was magnificent how they seized the opportunity and how they continued to push the Dutch back. The Netherlands finishing without a single shot on target.
Yeah, I think the crucial moment or crucial moments happened in the 1 minute when Tomáš Vaclík made a great save. Yeah, and then on the opposite side, there was the red card. So, and you could see the confidence of Czech team rise a lot. I feel it like my interviews about Czech teams are too boring, because I have to always repeat the same. Czech team, usually Czech team is based on a very good organization, team spirit, unity, and strong set pieces, and you could see all these factors today as a key factors, I would say. And all the players and coach after the game, when they spoke to TV, they all mentioned team spirit, unity. So I know it's quite boring, it's not sexy football from Czech team, but very, let's say, pragmatic.
Kara Haring there, Michael and Duncan. Well, there you go, Sunday afternoon. Fabulous entertainment, as long as you weren't Dutch. What exactly happened, though, Michael?
Like I said, I think the game just completely changed from that red card. I thought the Netherlands started okay. I thought Marlon was bright going in behind. He had that one-on-one chance just before the red card where he didn't even get a shot away. I thought Dumfries was again excellent. A couple of his runs from right wing back were exceptional. And it seemed to me like the Czechs were really just playing very reactively, almost man-marking midfield. And in some ways doing that pretty well. I think even before his goal and assist, I thought Holej and his almost man-marking job on Wijnaldum was really excellent. I haven't seen Wijnaldum nullified to that extent in this tournament. But yeah, then one... I don't think it was just a slip from De Ligt, actually. I must say, I think he misjudged it and got it wrong and then slipped and then tried to atone for his error, but that mistake just completely changed the game. And from there, Czech Republic with a better side, no question.
Mm. Even before that, the Dutch hadn't actually had a shot on target, and of course they finished without a single shot on target for the first time, I think, in recorded
ever
history in a tournament game. The red card, Duncan, you posit that it's tougher for international teams to play with 10 men than their club equivalents.
Well, our friend Jack Pitbrook tweeted that, and it reminded me that England have only ever scored one goal in their entire history. It went down to 10 men, which was a last-minute penalty from Raheem Sterling in away at Iceland, which is not possibly the toughest fixture ever. And you would expect that to be the case, I think, because the best coach teams are clubs, and they're the ones that can, you know, practice more with variants like being down to 10 men or whatever. So it did feel, as soon as that red card happened, you know, Czech Republic took the lead not long after. And you know, as you said, the Netherlands didn't have a single shot on target all match. I mean, they're called the low countries. Then maybe it should be the low shot count countries, because Belgium only had one in their whole game. So obviously, fairly crucial one. But yeah, I mean, that, as you said, was the first time they've ever gone a whole tournament game in recorded history without one. And ultimately, after getting 9 points from 9 in the group stage and being top scorers in the group stage, I did something earlier saying it's a bit like A-levels. It just gets you to the next stage, the group stage. It doesn't actually matter in the end. No one really remembers who got maximum points in a group stage. And
would it be more like GCSEs then?
Yeah, maybe. I mean, I think it works both ways. I mean, because when I remember getting to university and the tutor saying, whatever you learn in your A-level, forget about it, it's rubbish. So, you know.
what did you study at university, Duncan?
History. So he wasn't a fan of the history.
Time had moved on by that point, hadn't they? So.
Michael, I think there was a point you wanted to make about more recent history.
I don't know if it was tougher to reshape after going down to some international level, but I think it is tougher sometimes with a back three. I think especially when teams get a defender sent off, it means that they almost automatically end up going to back four because the wing-backs become full-backs, which is fine. But then really your entire game plan has changed. I mean, so much of what the Netherlands were doing at this tournament was getting Van Aanholt and Dumfries in behind, really, really high up the pitch. And they weren't doing that anymore. And they went to this 4-4-1 system. And it just looked like they didn't really have a plan. So I slightly feel for Frank de Boer. I think a lot of people were just so keen for him to fail. It almost seems like sometimes football coverage is, I don't know, starts with a meme and people's tactical analysis takes its cue from that. But, you know, Marlon had a one-on-one and then the centre-back decided to pick up the ball as the last man. There's only so much a manager can do to get players in certain positions, and sometimes players have to take responsibility as well. And there was two massive errors that have cost them this game and ultimately cost them their place in the tournament.
The Czechs, though, did anything from the group stage prepare you for that kind of performance? As Carol was saying, it's not sexy, but it's very effective.
Well, I mean, they didn't play that well against England, which says more about England's control, I guess. I mean, they didn't really try against Croatia, as far as I can recall, and they obviously won against Scotland, but lost on XG and shots and stuff like that. So, but I mean, it just goes back to that point that group stages don't actually tell you that much, because as soon as the knockout stages start, it's a 90 or 120 minute one-off match, and anything can happen, as you saw.
Okay. Thomas Hull is with the first goal. You were mentioning his fantastic job putting the genie back in the bottle, as it were, with Wijnaldum. And he also assisted a Patrick Schick's goal, which now Patrick Schick has scored four of the five Czech goals in this tournament. You'll no doubt wish to praise other players from their setup as well, as we cast a quick eye forward to the game with Denmark. What do you think? Can the Czechs make a real run of it in this tournament?
I think they're going to carry on playing quite reactively. I think that tactically they've been good at times. I would have Denmark as quite strong favourites for that game, in part because I think that what Denmark did yesterday really well was they reshaped the system after they realised what the opposition were trying to do. And it feels to me like the Czechs will come out, be reactive, maybe man mark again in midfield. But if Denmark have variations to get around that, I'd fancy them to progress. I'm still not convinced the Czechs are a particularly good side. I think they deserve some credit because they try to press. I think they're stronger than some of their parts because there aren't really any superstars here. But I think the Czech Republic might end up being the weakest of the eight quarterfinalists.
Mm-hmm. Although we thought they were probably one of the weakest of the last 16 as well.
I think they still are. They didn't play very well, right. Did they, really? I mean, people are going so OTT on the result.
Yeah, I thought Suchet had his best game of the tournament so far. Played more like his sort of West Ham Premier League Suchet we know. And I think he had three shots, which, you know, and as Michael pointed out earlier, Wijnaldum was very restricted. He only completed four passes in the first half, and two of those were in injury time.
Only 10 all game.
Yeah, 10 all game, which is the fewest by a Dutch player playing a whole match at a tournament, again, ever recorded. So, you know, and he was essentially the creative force for a lot of their group stage games. And everyone was like, wow, he's playing very differently to how he did for Liverpool. But today he was pretty anonymous. And I think that was partly down to some of the Czech players. So fair play on that. Mm.
Okay. It's stat of the tournament so far, the fact that De Ligt is the fourth Dutch player ever to see red in European Championship history. And all those have come either against the Czech Republic or erstwhile Czechoslovakia. Extraordinary. Extraordinary. One other thing we should mention from Sunday afternoon is the ongoing controversy over Hungary's reaction to rainbow-coloured symbols. This has been an increasingly hot topic after UEFA declined to allow the Germans to paint the Allianz Arena in rainbow colours, with lights, of course, for the game against Hungary, for fear of the perception of upsetting the Hungarian government, who've just passed laws banning the portrayal or promotion of homosexuality. A lot of people, I think, a lot of spectators, certainly at the Germany-Holland game, went along with rainbow symbols. I think a lot were intending to do it for this game. There's a lot of talk that they were prevented from bringing them into the fan areas. But it's, It's, I think, a yet more example of the fact that while UEFA say, well, these things are under the responsibility of local authorities, they shouldn't really be awarding hosting duties to places with dangerous right-wing governments like Budapest, Baku, or perhaps Wembley, if you want to add that one in there as well. Anyway, nice to see such a concerted reaction, though, from spectators and players, and indeed advertisers, although, you know, they'll have their own motives. But it is nice to see the kickback against this being so widespread. It would be lovely if UEFA then got on board as well. Next up, let's head to Seville for Belgium-Portugal.
The Euros are here, and we'd better make the most of them, because they only come around every 4-5 years. So if your bookie isn't making you feel special, then maybe it's time to find a new one. Yep, not so much carpe diem as carpa diem. If the grass is greener on the other side, come and play on it. If your bookie's not giving you the best rewards, switch, and you'll get a completely free £5 bet builder on England v Germany this Tuesday. Paddy Power. Pre-match bet builder bets only match one free bet, min 2 plus legs, online exclusive, must have previously deposited. T's and C's apply. NC+BeGambleAware.org.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
This is the Totally Football Show, part of the Athletic Podcast Network. Listen ad-free on the Athletic app and discover bonus content by following the Athletic UK Audio Plus on Apple Podcasts.
Guerrero sluit. Meunier. Thorgan Hazard. Knollen maar. Hazard! Thorgan Hazard met de 1-0. En zo gaat het dus als je durft uitvoetballen.
The other Hazard there with the goal that was the difference between the European title holders and the number one ranked side in the world. Belgium winning themselves a place in the quarterfinals, but losing Kevin De Bruyne and Eden Hazard, Torgan's brother, ahead of their game with Italy in Munich on Friday. It was a game that featured all the hits, Ronaldo squandering set pieces, Pepe getting booked. Duncan, I had the impression you spent most of it hoping for it to kick off, as it were.
Yeah, I mean, Portugal tournament games have got a fairly good history of, you know, ending up with their own Wikipedia pages. And it did feel at the start of the second half like there were a few niggles developing. And that did almost turn into a full-blown scrapping towards the end, particularly with Pepe getting involved in a few scenarios. But it didn't quite happen. I think extra time would have probably pushed both teams over the edge. I think everyone by the end of the match was sort of hoping for extra time. Maybe not us.
Yeah.
I don't think Belgium did that well. But it kind of, this game fits into my new theory, i.e. one I invented yesterday, that it's not teams at this tournament, it's stadiums that are kind of shaping it. So you get a lot of the stadiums that are kind of producing the same sorts of games. So if you ignore the quite considerable off-the-field stuff at Budapest, most of the games at that stadium have been pretty good matches. Wembley games have all been fairly not that exciting. And this, all the games in Seville have been pretty bad quality. And I think a lot of it is down to the pitch, which is essentially where people normally throw javelins at an athletic stadium. And it does sort of cut up like it is not the greatest soil and grass combo ever put down.
Fair enough. Michael, what do you think of Duncan's theory?
Yeah, I hadn't considered it properly until he says it, but I think he's absolutely spot on. I think with Seville as well, I mean, it's just a rubbish stadium, isn't it? It's a classic old school, you know, athletic stadium, really. It's not really used for football matches anymore, I think, aside from the Copa del Rey. One positive is that people have stopped calling it the Olympic Stadium, because it really annoys me when there's an Olympic stadium that's never hosted an Olympics. So I'm pleased they've got over that. But it's a good point. And it wasn't a good game today, in my opinion. It was just slightly disappointing, I would say.
Before we get on to the game, does anybody know why the Spanish authorities didn't hand hosting duties to either Betis's ground or the Sanchez-Pizjuan?
I think in general they have been keen to just give games they can to this ground because it's there and it's not really being used for anything. I mean, it has hosted... It hosted the UEFA Cup final back in the day, didn't it? And it hosts the Copa del Rey final. And I think quite a few Spanish national side games. So maybe there's a feeling that we need to use this ground for something. We've got these games, might as well have them there. But yeah, I mean, we can all have our opinions on the architecture of the stadium, but for the pitch not to be in good nick when you've got the choice of stadiums across Europe does seem pretty poor form, doesn't it?
Indeed, indeed. All right, well, the game, as you say, a little bit disappointing. It picked up a bit in the second half. Belgium, meanwhile, experiencing their first real test here. Did they live up to their billing as kind of number one in the world for you?
I was a bit disappointed. I thought that from both teams, actually, everyone just seemed to attack as individuals. And I thought that the goal was obviously brilliant. But if there was going to be a brilliant goal in this game, it was by someone just doing something on their own. I didn't think there was any chance of a really good team goal. I mean, I thought a defining feature of the game, as well as the constant danger that things would spill over, was just teammates looking really stroppy at one another. I mean, Lukaku just seemed absolutely exasperated with all his teammates. Obviously, Ronaldo joined in those theatrics as well. And even João Felix, when he came in, was... I think it was Bruno Fernandes took a shot, and he was just really showing his frustration, which I quite enjoyed. But I didn't think there was... Yeah, there just weren't any teammates on the same wavelength, with the notable exception of the two Hazard brothers, and that produced the goal.
Yeah, Ronaldo's XG numbers were very high, but XG stands for expected gestures, because it's one of the best things to do when you watch Portugal is, if someone else has a shot, as quick as you can, find Ronaldo and look at what he's doing, and invariably, he's not that happy with it. He actually played okay in the second half. He like actually went out wide for a bit and did a couple of very slow stepovers, and you know, was a little bit of a presence. But Portugal managed to rack up 23 shots without... I know they hit the post and they forced a good close range save from Courtois, but they never really kind of got that up, that sort of head of steam that you know, made you feel like they were going to sort of return it round. You know, they've got this record of, is it 2 wins in 12 at the Euros in 90 minutes now? You know, and yeah, they might come out of this game and say, oh, we were really unlucky against Belgium, but, you know, 5 years ago, they were very lucky to get as far as they did. So, as always in football, these things do sort of even out eventually.
Unless they're Ronaldo free kicks, because we should mention that if he's making gestures at other people's attempts to score goals, what must the rest of the team be doing with him? What are the numbers now?
So now it's 52 direct free kicks at World Cups and Euros. He scored one. It's a good one, but it's baffling how commentators, as soon as he gets one, still say, well, there's no one he'd rather be stood over this than Ronaldo. He's like one of the least effective free kick takers ever. And actually, I was watching, you know, the famous one he scored for Manchester United that started the knuckleball against Portsmouth.
Yeah,
I watched that go the other day, and the commentator, as he steps up, says, Ronaldo's got a hit and miss record with free kicks, but we'll see how this one turns out. And then it obviously turns out well. So it's funny that the free kick that kind of, you know, made his name at that point, everyone was like, not sure he's any good at them. And then basically he's been kind of living off that one ever since.
Well, it's funny because they seem to sear themselves into the kind of consciousness. He became the free kick taker. I remember when Janinho was having one of his wonderful seasons with Leon, Richard Keys coming back off a highlights package saying, oh, he's been watching Ronaldo in action then, you know, after seeing Janinho working his match. Statistically the greatest free kick taker ever, apart from Sinisa Mihalovic. But I mean, the other example of that, of course, would be Roberto Carlos, who did it at the tournoi and lived off that for the rest of all time.
I think that's the issue, isn't it? When there's a really memorable free kick, because I think subtly another one is Marcus Rashford, who scored that really good dipping one away at Stamford Bridge. But you look at his record, and I think he's on 1 in 40, 1 in 45, or something like that.
Really?
So it's almost like, yeah, if you score a real YouTube classic, that's the worst thing that can happen, because it seems to override the statistical analysis.
What about David Beckham? Was he actually not very good at free kicks?
No, he was good.
Oh, no, he was very good.
He was good. Okay.
He's got the Premier League record, and you know, he scored from all across the penalty box, and you know, geographically. And yeah, his technique was really good. So I think he's very different. He is the kind of probably, you know, one of the few people where his reputation did match his ability, you know, as opposed to someone who's very good like Janinho, but didn't get enough credit for it. So I mean, Harry Kane's another one, takes a lot of them for Spurs and England. I think he's only scored one or two in his whole career. And yet people have a problem with him taking corners rather than direct free kicks. But there you go.
Lukaku continues in this tournament. What about his performance in this game?
I thought he did okay. Like I said, I don't think he had... Well, one, I don't think he had great service, and two, I don't think he had great support, really. I thought he held the ball up well in the final 20-30 minutes when he was up against two very physical centre-backs. Kind of gave Belgium the ability to get up the pitch, but in the first half, I thought he was fairly quiet. I don't think any of the attackers really came off this game particularly well, to be honest. And obviously with Belgium, the worry is that both Hazard and De Bruyne went off injured. And if you create a side without their individual magic, then it's a lot less enticing without Hazard and De Bruyne.
Yeah, I mean, Eden Hazard, I thought, really improved after De Bruyne was substituted. I mean, I don't think the two things are connected, but he looked actually pretty effective in the second half. And then, lo and behold, does his hamstring, which if he has, he probably won't feature for the rest of the tournament, you think. I mean, I don't know, the De Bruyne injury, that might just be more of a kind of jarring impact one. But again, I think a lot of that was down to the pitch as well. So, yeah, I don't think Belgium will look back at Sevilla with a lot of enjoyment.
I mean, with Hazard, I agree, actually, he was good in the second half, wasn't he? And it felt to me almost like he'd slightly started to learn how to play with his physical limitations, if that makes sense, because we didn't really see so much of the acceleration and trying to get past players, but there was a lot of like very clever flicks around the corner, and it almost reminded me of like very late era Francesco Totti, when he could barely run anymore but was still the best player around at just playing those passes between the lines. So I hope he comes back, well, I hope he's fit for the next game, because I think in general he's been pretty good in tournaments. I know there's some levels of football, the Champions League, for example, he doesn't really play well at. But tournament football, I do always really enjoy, really look forward to watching him.
Of the four teams that have made it through so far to the quarterfinals, Italy, the Czech Republic, Belgium and Denmark, who have you liked most?
I think Italy have been the most consistent. You know, they've deserved to win all four of their games. Denmark have shown the biggest improvement, I would say. Obviously, you can't really count their first game for Christian Eriksen reasons, but the second game, they were incredibly wasteful, you know, just really, really wasteful. And then suddenly in the third match, started scoring long-range goals and have continued that. You know, the first team ever in the Euros to score four goals in consecutive matches. So they're on a nice trajectory, but I think Italy have shown a sort of consistency and a kind of doggedness, particularly at Wembley, that is the kind of hallmark of a team that can win a tournament. So if I was a Belgian fan, I would be concerned about playing Italy, because I think, you know, they've got options on the bench, which Belgium increasingly have less of after tonight.
Yeah, I'd agree with Duncan. I mean, I always look at the goals against column, and Italy only conceded one goal in four games. In fact, four games and a bit, because that goal was in extra time. I just feel the key probably is a few changes of personnel, isn't it? I mean, they won the game yesterday, really, because of their strength and depth from the bench. But I'd be surprised if Chiesa didn't start the next game. I think there's maybe an argument for Locatelli, although I can't see him leaving Verratti out. But I thought Locatelli, again, did really well when he came on. So maybe he'll rotate and mix and match. But yeah, I think Italy, they don't really have a standout world-class attacker for me. But I think if Mancini can use the options at the right moment, I think they can get past Belgium in the next round.
We shall see. A little bit later on, we'll be having a bit of On This Day in Euro History with some classic Azzurri action featuring one of their more infamous strikers. And next up, though, let's get on to Monday's Last 16 action.
Hello, I'm Mark Chapman, host of The England Show, brought to you daily throughout Euro 2020. I'll be joined by writers from The Athletic and special guests to bring you unrivaled coverage dedicated to the England team this summer. So for expert insight into Southgate's squad and post-game reaction to all the games, search for The England Show wherever you get your podcasts or via The Athletic app.
On Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Smart Speaker, and now ad-free on The Athletic, this is The Totally Football Show with James Richardson.
¿Qué es esto? Obra de arte de Isco. España de ensueño 6, Croacia 0.
Spain of Dreams 6, Croatia 0. Yep, Croatia in Copenhagen are facing the side that just under 3 years ago did that to them. A 6-0 defeat in the Nations League, their heaviest loss ever. It was Spain, of course. Can they get revenge this time around? Or could Spain get an even bigger scoreline? Well, Juraj Vrdoljak joins us now of Telesport in Croatia. Juraj, first of all, Spain and that 6-0, what are your memories of that?
I mean, the defeat against Spain in the Nations League was obviously very shocking, especially because it came just after the World Cup campaign, where Croatia sort of had to present themselves in a bit of a perhaps different light to kind of preserve the status of a World Cup finalist. And it was a huge, huge upset, although people didn't really perceived it as a, I mean, it was a big blow, but considering it was in the Nations League, people were surprised, but not really kind of very concerned. Although it was seen more as a fluke in Croatia, as a one-time fluke, as a sort of a warning not to get very comfortable in our new position. So yeah, it was a weird one, but it wasn't received as bad as people would have thought.
Okay. Well, 3 years on, they've just done a similar number on Slovakia, 5-0 in their most recent game at these Euros. And Croatia come into this latest meeting with Spain with the terrible news that Ivan Perisic has tested positive for COVID-19. I wish him the best. In football terms, where does this leave you?
Well, the news that Ivan Perisic is out was really a huge shock, especially because Croatia took all of the more or less precautions possible to protect the team from infection. They've even decided to travel from Croatia to the games in the UK, but it turns out that even that wasn't enough. So it didn't. Purely sporting term, is a huge, huge miss. Ivan is well known as being perhaps our biggest big games player for the big occasions. He's now, with these two goals he scored in the group stage, he's now equaled the Davor Šuker's record as the best goal scorer on the major tournaments as well, for 9 goals in 14 games. So it's obviously a big, big loss, especially because he's adapting both attacking the set defense, and he's really, really great in counter. He's really still very agile, very physical player as well. So it will be a huge miss. It's hard to say at the moment who will jump in. Most likely it will be Ante Rebic, but Mislav Orsic of Dinamo Zagreb, who sank Tottenham with his hat-trick, is also a contender on the winger position. So we'll have to see the latest info from the camp after this shock subsides a bit.
How would you rate the campaign so far ahead of this match with Spain?
It was a kind of a roller coaster of a campaign so far, because we've previously had a chat, and there were quite a number of issues surrounding this team, with the formations, with the sort of relationship in the between the players, and there were kind of questions glooming over Zlatko Dalic as well. There were pressure on him. He didn't handle the pressure very well, but fortunately things have finally clicked against Scotland. My opinion on the Scotland game is that it's more or less when this group of players is most comfortable, they have enough individual quality to see off such an opponent. But for the next round, for the knockout stages, we'll need a bit of more than that. So Croatia is still the best when there are a lot of questions asked, and this Spain game, it just might help them that they've avoided the worst scenario, and that kind of unloaded the burden off their chest. So I think they're going to present themselves in a good light, but it's yet to see will that be enough against the likes of Spain.
All right, what kind of percentage chance do you give yourselves?
Oh, it's hard to say. I'm not really good with that type of predictions, but I think that there's, I'd say it's still, Spain is still a favorite. How much? I'd rate about 60-40% for Spain, but it could turn quite easily in Croatia's favor as well.
Jurajver Doljak. So Croatia, no pressure, but no Perisic. Spain, meantime, I read with interest that it's been 9 years since they made it past the last 16 of a major tournament. That's remarkable. Are they going to do it this time?
Yeah, I'd favour Spain. I think it's a rare game at this tournament between two sides who will probably look to dominate possession. So it should be hopefully quite a high tempo game, certainly in in terms of sides looking to dominate the ball. I quite like Spain, I must say. I think that even in their first two games, they worked the ball into good positions. And I tend to have faith in strikers that get into good zones but can't quite apply the finish, that eventually they'll come good. Morata is testing my faith a little bit, I think it's fair to say. But I fancy them to create more chances than Croatia, who, I must say, I don't completely get their attacking section of the side. I think they have slightly used Rebic in a weird way. And also without Ivan Perisic, who just consistently seems to produce at tournaments, particularly in terms of goals, I think the absence of him is a real big blow, because I don't think Croatia have too many other goal scorers.
Croatia may be advised to play for penalties, actually. Spain having missed their last five spot kicks. Croatia won two shootouts en route to the World Cup final in 2018. One thing about Spain, and you mentioned the draws against Sweden and Poland, which left them facing the possibility of elimination if you squinted really hard. Busquets coming back against Slovakia, was that the big difference, why they kind of suddenly blossomed, or was it the fact they were playing Slovakia?
I think probably more that they were playing Slovakia. I mean, right. You know, five
was
goals.
Was it the stadium?
Well, they did prove that some teams can play. I mean, Busquets is probably, you know, the good sort of player to have on a pitch that's cutting up. You know, he's been around the block. He's seen these things before. But yeah, I mean, Spain, they've become a sort of, as Michael pointed out earlier about memes that people then just wrap stuff around. But, you know, the meme of old Morata and Moreno wasting chances. But Spain had the highest XG in the group stage of any team. They still scored six goals in the group stage. You know, I mean, they're creating good chances. They're playing well as a team. They're pressing the ball really, really well high up the pitch and winning that back, probably better than anyone else in the tournament. So, and I think Croatia's ageing side might struggle with that as well. So, I mean, I quite enjoy watching this Spain, and I can't say that for Spain in a lot of previous tournaments, even ones where they've won the trophy sometimes. So, yeah, I expect them to do well in this game, and I'm expecting goals from Spain, to be honest.
Right. Well, if they do get through, they'll be facing France or Switzerland in the quarterfinals. France and the Swiss, who go at it on Monday as well. We'll talk about that encounter next.
We're all driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. You can use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. According to their own survey, 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites. Remember the last time you were hiring and how slow and overwhelming it was? Well, you don't need to go through all that again. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent. And because you listen to the Totally Football Show, Indeed is going to give you a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/totally. That's Indeed.com/totally. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed at Indeed.com.
This is the Totally Football Show, part of the Athletic Podcast Network.
Monday's late game is France against Switzerland in Bucharest. Julien Laurens joins us now on the line. Jules, I've got your world champions, Benzema's great, Paris born and bred on my bingo card, so I'm feeling pretty confident about this chat. But tell us something we don't know about France after that group stage. What have you learnt from your two draws and just one win?
We haven't learned too much from what we didn't know before. Complacency that sometimes can creep in that team, we knew it before, is still there. We saw it against Hungary, where I think they took that game for granted when clearly he was going to be tougher than what they thought. Apart from that, they were impressive against Germany, which we expected. They were very good in the second half against Portugal, not so much in the first half. That was a very slow start for them, and maybe that's what we learn, and it's a bit worrying if for every big game they're going to play from now on, starting against Switzerland on Monday night, if they take 45 minutes to get into the game or 40 minutes to get into the game, then they could run into trouble. But I don't think we've learned much. This is a team that thrives on knockout stages games anyway. This is a team that thrives on those big, you're in and then you're out if you lose. Always. They've always been better once the tournament reaches this kind of phase than before. So it's not surprising. What could surprise you, Jimbo, maybe, is that it looks like they could change formation and go with a back three, which is something that Deschamps tried a little bit in the last 18 months, but something that we didn't really see coming, to be fair, until some injuries arrived.
I see. Well, yeah, I am very taken aback by that. What's going on with Kylian Mbappe? Where are his shooting boots, Jules?
I love this English expression of shooting boots. Well, clearly he left them in France. Otherwise, he would have worn them and he would have scored loads of goals, wouldn't he, Jimbo?
Mm, right. Okay. Is there much concern about him or anything amongst the French public and press?
No, so more seriously, it's not a worry yet because, again, it's only the group stages. At the World Cup in 2018, for example, he only scored once in the group stages. And he was a different player. He was much stronger, of course. Mm-hmm. But it's not worrying for now. He's the only one who hasn't scored of that front three. Griezmann has scored, Benzema has scored, as you said. But he had some good games or good moments at times in those first three games. Against Germany, I thought he was a real threat. There's that ball for Rabiot that ended up on the post. There's the goal that he scored that was disallowed for an offside that was rightly offside, but a mini offside. Same with the Benzema goal that he assisted. So there was a lot of good things. Hungary, I think he lost his way a bit like the rest of the team because of that complacency. And then Portugal, mm-hmm. It was not the greatest, but I still thought at times that he looked threatening. So he will get there. Again, physically, he did a lot of work with Deschamps to be at 100% or to peak now for the last 16 onwards. So I expect him to be very good against the Swiss and then for the rest of the competition.
Right, if indeed there is one. Meantime, Michael here suggesting on the Zonal Marking podcast that Paul Pogba is the player of the tournament so far. Would you agree?
100%. Completely. I picked him on Five Live in the show that we do as my player of the tournament so far. He was amazing against the Germans, really. It was not too bad. It was certainly the best French players who were bad against Hungary. And then I thought against Portugal, he was fantastic. Even in the first half when the French had a slow start, he lost a couple of balls. But after that, he was so dominant in midfield. I've rarely seen him in that kind of form. Even in 2018, he was not that good, certainly from the start of the tournament. Yesterday at training, right at the end, we were watching and he asked for Marc Maignan to kick the ball from almost like the six-yard box, let's say. And he said, look, I'm going to do a special first touch, right? A special control. So the ball comes 40 yards in the air and he's got his back to where the ball was coming from, so towards Maignan, and he controlled it, letting the ball go between his leg and then with the outside of his foot forward, like if he was attacking the other goal. It was an amazing piece of skill. And I think he really feels like just nothing can stop him. No one can stop him, that he's at his best. And he has this leadership that is even more there than before. He's just the big boss in that team. And that was a slow process. But right now, he's so important to them. And I agree with Mike. He's the best player so far in this tournament.
He's certainly got his passing boots on. And by the way, I would think that shooting boots in French would make a lot of sense because they would be boots de boots, no? Sort of. Anyway, let's finish off with this, Jules. You mentioned Switzerland and, I think I'm right in saying, the tournament beyond. It's fair that Switzerland looks like a reasonably simple round of 16 opponent, but then so did Austria for the Italians and so did the Czechs for the Dutch. So should you not be a little bit more cautious of a team that's drawn four of the last five meetings with you?
Yeah, although the difference between Italy, France and the Netherlands is that the Netherlands don't really have a good coach, unlike the French and the Italians. So that could make the very different story. I think that this is a team that France should beat, despite the talent that they have, and they are a talented team. But we saw in the group stages, but also in past tournaments, that it gets to a point where they show their limits. And you're right, it's only one win in the last five for France. But that was a very important one at the World Cup. And I think this France team has an edge over the Switzerland team. And that if they all turn up, and again, the most I'm worried about, James, is complacency. And I really think, as I've been saying many times, that the worst enemy of this French team is ourselves, is the French themselves. And I really hope that comes Monday night, Deschamps and Pogba, as we said about the leadership, and the rest of the team realizes that this is a tough game, because you're right, it's a tough game. It's not an easy game at all. And that if you don't all turn up 100%, you might not qualify, and or it might be tough like Italy, or you might not do it at all like the Netherlands. So I really hope they've got that mindset, which again, I think they do when it gets to the group stages. This is really when the tournament starts. We saw it in 2016, we saw it in 2018, even to a certain extent 2014. And I think they will be there again, and I don't think Switzerland will be strong enough to stop them.
Julian Aron's there. Always a delight to hear from him. And check out whatever it was that Pogba did in training. I'm a bit mystified about that. Michael, have you seen it?
No, I haven't. It sounds great.
It does, doesn't it? All right.
It's how you win tournaments, isn't it? It's doing stuff in training. Little flicks. That's
Well,
get extra points for that.
Okay. What do you make of this game then?
I struggle to see Switzerland winning just because I just can't envision Switzerland getting past France in the second round of the year. I just can't imagine that possibility, having seen Switzerland over the last 10 years or so. The only thing I can think is that maybe Mbolo up against Varane. I think Mbolo's had a really good tournament so far. Another player, a little bit like Perisic, who always seems to impress me at tournaments and doesn't quite live up to the billing for his club. And France's defensive shape has been a bit odd. They've changed system a couple of times. They've now gone back to the system they used at the World Cup, which obviously worked very well at the World Cup because they won it. But I think sometimes it's a bit imbalanced. Sometimes they're a little bit more exposed down one side than the other. And with their problems at fullback, both on the left, where they've got a couple of players out injured, and on the right, we're not quite sure what's happening. Maybe Pavard, you know, has suggestions he might come back. I'm not quite sure why. Maybe Switzerland could have some joy attacking down the flanks, but I just think France will have too much. The front three really is quite special. I'm not sure they've completely clicked as a trio, but obviously individually they've all been capable of great moments. And, you know, as you say, I think Pogba's been fantastic so far. I think his passing range has been fantastic. So I never really expect fireworks from France, but I don't expect them to go out either.
I still enjoy the fact that the goal against Hungary just came from a massive kick from Lloris, like in a League Two game that Mbappe just chased down and eventually squared, and it got to Griezmann. But yeah, I mean, I think the same as Michael, I can't see Switzerland getting past them. I mean, I don't want to go all swimming pool guard in the day-to-day, but this is where they get to, isn't it? You know, in the 2014 World Cup, they got to the last 16 and lost. In Euro 2016, they got to the last 16 and lost. In the 2018 World Cup, they got to the last 16 and lost.
But this might be the incident with the trend. Pigeon. This year here might
it
be the incident
be.
With
no,
the pigeon.
No, we've already had the incident with the pigeon at the Euros. In the Germany, one of the Germany games. So, yeah, because there was
in 2021, Switzerland went through. In 2024.
Yeah. Jules' dreams died, etc.
Well, we'll see, Duncan. We'll see. We don't have long to wait. Monday evening, that game will roll around. Very shortly, we'll have some more old school class with On This Day. First of all, though, let's get some odds from Paddy Power. Let's head over to producer Ben.
Thank you very much, Jimbo. It's Jason Murphy from Paddy Power on the line again. Don't fast forward this bit, listeners. There's good stuff coming up. And Jason, show us how good it is. Tell us the overalls, please, for Croatia versus Spain and where the best value is.
Yeah, so Spain to win in 90 minutes is 4-7. Croatia 11-2 to qualify. Spain shortened to 2-7 to get the job done. But Croatia at 5-2 might be worth a look. First of all, we told people not to worry about Spain. They got the two draws against Sweden and Poland. But if you look at the games, they created the chances, just didn't take them. But they cashed in that XG, so they did against Slovakia, with a bit of help from De Bruyne and others. But listen, does Luis Enrique know his best team? I don't think he does. And that's part of the issue here why Croatia are worth a look, because Pekovic coming in with a world-class midfield three behind it. I think having a look at Croatia at those prices to cause an upset, I'd be a little bit worried for Spanish backers really going into the game. I think this is one where, if we're going to see an upset in the last 16, this is potentially where it could happen.
All right, well, I don't see much of an upset happening in Switzerland versus France, but perhaps there's a little bit of value in Switzerland not losing in the 90 minutes. Can you give us some of the numbers here, please?
Yeah, so the Swiss not losing 90 minutes, it's a market that we offer. It's essentially the double chance market. So you're saying at 90 minutes, it's either a draw or a Swiss win. And the price on that is 6-4. And of course, it is possible. But if you look at that Swiss team against Italy in particular, we still consider this French team a cut above that Italy team. And the Swiss just never laid a glove. Like, if you look at the stats, look at the eye test. the Swiss were just really poor. Whereas Benzema is now up and running. He's got, since his international tournament, got the two goals the other night against Portugal. With the attacking talent that the French have, I think there's potential, despite Deschamps being quite conservative, for them to actually cut loose here a little bit, similar to what we've seen in the World Cup against Argentina in the first knockout game, once to go to the groups to put four past the Argentinians. I could see something similar here. And if you look at the movement Locatelli made against the Swiss, potentially if you're doing bet builders with Paddy Power for this game, have a look at Pogba, maybe do something similar. Not quite as good a 1-2, but give and go and get in the box. He's 5-1 anytime to score in this game, but really cannot see the Swiss causing an upset here against the French.
The Totally Football Show, sponsored by Paddy Power. Find a bookie who loves you right back as much as Gareth loves right backs. Place a 4+ fold bet builder on any football match and get money back as a free bet if one leg lets you down. Check paddypower.com for more details. £10 max free bet. T's and C's apply. 18+. BeGambleAware.org.
Ooh, sign up for a subscription with The Athletic and you'll get unrivaled coverage of Euro 2020, all the articles, all the podcasts ad-free, and Q&As with writers, all for just £1 a month for your first 6 months. Head to theathletic.com/totally. On this day in Euros history, I'm talking about the 28th of June 2012, do you know what happened?
All'altezza della metà campo e lancia Balotelli, posizione regolare di Balotelli. Balotelli entra in area di rigore, il tiro, rate! Rate! Si toglie la maglia Balotelli. Festeggia, verrà ammonito. L'Italia raddoppia, gentili radioascoltatori, al 36esimo, Germania 0, Italia 2, doppietta di Balotelli.
È una statua d'Ebano che si sta scagliando nel cielo di Varsavia. Loosely translated, it's a big ebony statue that's looming in the Warsaw sky. This was Mario Balotelli with the brace against Germany in the Euro 2012 semi-final. 2-1 the victory for Italy. One of the best nights of Mario Balotelli's career. And he did actually have quite a few, but perhaps the one that internationally, at least, people really remember him for. Also, I don't know if you've seen these goals at all recently, but it was a standout performance from Juan Antonio Cassano, who was the other kind of great unrealized talent of recent Italy history. He looked absolutely... I mean, he was very much... You were talking earlier about Totti just kind of strolling around and stroking balls around. Cassano, because he literally couldn't be asked, was just stood there stationary and just kind of knocking balls past the German defenders. Magnificent stuff.
I actually saw a reference to Cassano today. He was doing some punditry, I think, was talking about Mancini's selection. And the report just mentioned that he appeared 3 European Championships for Italy, which amazed me just because it makes it, from that, it almost makes him out to be this real consistent player who was, you know, at the top of his game for such a long period of time when the truth was anything but. But no, he was brilliant at that tournament. I liked his partnership with Balotelli worked really well. And the second goal, the Balotelli's, where he blasts it into the top corner in a kind of one-on-one. Don't think I've ever seen a one-on-one finish like that. Mm. And I always think it's maybe just because Balotelli, he didn't fear missing. You know, I almost think the consequences of him missing was not a big deal. And I can't imagine him kind of panicking in that situation. But it's just the most emphatic one-on-one finish you'll ever see.
He also scored that goal for City, didn't he, when the ball dropped down and he just shouldered it in like that, which again is not a manoeuvre most players would risk, I would think. So, I mean, my memory from that tournament is, was it 5 players that finished on 3 goals at the end? And they decided the golden boot on an assist that... not that clear assist from Fernando Torres, which seemed a little bit harsh. I think golden boot should be purely on the number of goals scored. They should have shared it between the 5 players, but it is what it is.
How can you do that?
Well, there are lots of things are shared in football.
I suppose. All right. Well, it ushered in a glorious era for the Azzurri, who went on to lose 4-0 to Spain in the final. Germany, meanwhile, picked themselves up and won the World Cup 2 years later. While Italy got knocked out by Uruguay in that Suarez biting Chiellini game.
Which led to, I think, Jan Agafyrtoft on Twitter biting his own hand to prove that what an actual bite would look like, and this wasn't a bite. It was that was a good night.
So his suggestion was that Suarez didn't bite Chiellini.
Yeah, because I think Chiellini showed the mark, and that his theory was that's not a bite mark and I'll prove it. I'll bite my own hand and then show people what that looks like. I'm not sure that if that's how bites are classified, but...
No. I mean, the hand is fleshier than the shoulder, and particularly Chiellini's shoulder, I'm thinking. So you're going to leave more of an indentation. I wasn't aware that there was any controversy about Suarez having a nibble. I thought that was pretty much, documented. But anyway, happy days, happy days. There'll be more of that kind of thing, no doubt, in Tuesdays, totally at the Euros, which will feature Daniel Story and Carl Anker and their thoughts on Monday's games. We have come to the end of our rainbow, though. Duncan and Michael, anything you want to add before we salute the listener?
Well, I don't think there's much chance of rainbow given the amount of rain that's falling right now, but although that is one of the ingredients, so you never know.
Here's one quick thing I'd like to say, which I probably should have said about a minute ago. You know, everyone's talking about Mancini and how he's revolutionised Italy with their style of play. I mean, Prandelli's Italy played really good football, didn't they? I mean, the four great passing midfielders with their Pirlo, Verratti was some. He was there in the World Cup. Montolivo was there. De Rossi was there. Thiago Motta was there. And like we've already spoken about the two up front. So nothing against Mancini. He's done a really good job. And of course, was taking over after a really poor period for Italian football. But I'd like to give a bit of praise to Prandelli because I think he was a great coach and obviously a great guy as well, who we might not see back in football again by the sounds of his resignation from Fiorentina. So, yeah.
Also, Pirlo in the extra time against England in that tournament was the most controlled extra time performance I've ever seen. He completed more passes than England did themselves. And it was it was so dominant. There were points where England had 11 men virtually in their own box and were just lumping it down the pitch, and it was just one-way traffic, but it's fine. We'll take them to penalties. That'll work out well.
Very good. Well, a lovely addendum or postscript, if you will. I look forward to seeing you guys back on Totally soon. Many thanks for this evening and to producer Charlie and listener. I hope you've enjoyed it. Do join us again Tuesday morning. For now, from all of us here, it's goodbye.
You've been listening to the Totally Football Show, part of the Athletic Podcast Network. Listen ad-free on the Athletic app and discover bonus content by following the Athletic UK Audio Plus on Apple Podcasts. Keep up to date with everything Totally at the Totally Show on Twitter and find out the very latest subscription offers at theathletic.com/totally. The Totally Football Show is an Athletic Media Company production and sponsored by Paddy Power.
The Athletic.